guys, welcome back to All the Buzz. I am so excited about today's episode because we are somewhere very special with a woman who is truly inspirational. We're not in our normal studio in New York City, which you can see. We are somewhere extremely fabulous. The one and only Gray Gardens Estate in the heart of East Hampton. And joining me is a woman who truly made pregnancy and maternity wear fashionable for the very first time and now has taken over the brand Fig. Liz Lang. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Sydney.
Good to see you.
You as well. Welcome.
I am so happy to be here. I mean, I have to admit, I have been here before.
We're friends.
But this home is the most incredible home in the Hamptons. I mean, does it, like, do you pinch yourself when you walk in here sometimes?
Well, that's very nice. Thank you. There's so many gorgeous homes around here. But I do feel very, very lucky. And especially as these flowers start to bloom, which is happening now when I pull up. I just can't believe, you know, how magical the setting is.
What made you want to purchase this home?
Well, I grew up coming to East Hampton. My family house was just around the corner. So I was very familiar with this area. Yeah. And I've always loved it. To me, it feels like home. And this house feels kind of like home. I mean, obviously, I'm not a Kennedy or a Beale, and I didn't live here. But you know, these old shingle-style homes, that's what I remember from my childhood growing up in the Hamptons. I know today most homes have been torn down and they're modern, but this is what all the houses looked like in this neighborhood. So for me, this house felt very familiar.
And I want to familiarize our audience a little bit, who might be a little bit younger, about the history of Gray Gardens. So really fast, this home in the 1800s was lived in by one of the relatives of Jackie Kennedy, and she was like a hoarder. I mean, right? Like the house was in bad shape.
It was a mother and daughter who were first cousin and aunt of Jackie Kennedy. They were, you know, very, very fancy people who bought this house, you know, as a family in the early 1900s, actually. They bought this house as their country cottage. They belonged to the Maidstone Club, which is a very exclusive club out here.
Do you belong there?
I do not.
Okay.
They were very, 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 I mean, for lack of a better word, just fancy, you know, part of the society. And things went badly for them, I guess, financially. And there was a divorce. And somehow the mother and daughter ended up living here, never leaving, like two crazy people, eating cat food. Most of the house had become unusable because there had been fires. There were raccoons. I mean, it was unbelievable. The town was actually about to condemn it. And the house is famous because the Maisel brothers, who were very famous documentary filmmakers at the time, came here, heard about it, did a documentary about it, and the documentary took off, what today we would call became viral.
Right.
It's one of the most popular documentaries. You can see it. HBO did a remake of it, and so the house is one of the more famous homes in America just as a house.
Right, it's wild. And there's also a movie, Drew Barrymore, right, stars in it.
That's the HBO version. Yes, there was a play. It's crazy.
It's crazy. I went to the play. There was actually a play at the Bay Street Theater in Sag Harbor about like a decade ago. And, you know, it's just amazing to feel that like there's such a huge piece of history right here in the Hamptons and you live in it.
That part is very cool. I don't think I fully appreciated it until we bought it and started and renovated it and then lived here. The level of sort of fans that this house has and interest in it. I mean, most days, our driveway gates are filled with people trying to peer over, take photos. There are about five or six Facebook groups that are just dedicated solely to commenting on the house, commenting on every move we make, how we've decorated and what we're doing. Yes.
Do these people reach out to you ever?
Sometimes they do. And I get a huge kick out of them, so I don't take it all personally at all. Couldn't care less. But sometimes they're flattering. Sometimes they're far less than flattering.
I'm sure.
You can imagine. Yeah. And sometimes I go on Facebook and interact with them, and sometimes I don't. But yeah.
That is crazy. Okay, you have talked about in interviews, like people always ask you, are you afraid of ghosts? You've said many times you're not. You don't feel the presence of ghosts, but do you feel the presence of just the history, or do you feel like you've really just renovated it to the point where it just feels like Liz Lang's house now?
That's such a good question. I mean, on the one hand, it very much feels just like my house. We really did, even though we were as faithful as we could possibly be. We spent very long time restoring this house and trying to get it back to its absolute glory years before everything kind of went pear-shaped.
Yeah.
And you're right. I have to be honest, I don't believe in ghosts. So no, I don't feel they're ghosts, but I do feel the history, as you said, of this house and the women that lived here before me, and, you know, both the Beale women, who were the mother and daughter that we were discussing, and even, you know, Sally Quinn and Ben Bradley, who we bought the house from. Ben Bradley was the very well-known editor-in-chief of the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. He broke the Watergate story. Sally Quinn was his, she's still alive, but she's was his, you know, very famous Washington hostess wife. They were quite the glamorous couple. And I, you know, I think all the time about the people that lived here before we did and how cool that is.
It really is amazing. And I feel like this is just such a home of, you know, creative inspiration for you as a creative. And I want to start talking about your career, because obviously this podcast focuses on the paths that entrepreneurs take, you know, into making it today. And you have had such an extensive career in fashion. And going back, I just remember being, what, like 9 years old. My mom was pregnant with my brother, and you would walk along Madison Avenue, and like, where was, you know, where were these women going to get pregnancy clothes, maternity clothes that were fashionable back in the early 2000s? You went to one place, Liz Lang Maternity. What made you decide to launch your own line of pregnancy wear? Do people call pregnancy wear?
No, I think really we call it maternity clothing. Maternity, I don't even know. It's both. I mean, you're certainly accurate.
Yeah.
You know, I don't, looking back, I don't even know how I did it, but it was that I had always been interested in fashion. First, I worked at Vogue magazine after college, and then I worked for a struggling designer who sadly is no longer in business, but I loved what he was doing. I did not consider myself a designer because I wasn't a designer,
yeah.
But at that time, and it was actually 1997, my friends were starting to get married. I was very young. I was just newly married myself, and they were starting to get pregnant, and they were all complaining, and they had nothing to wear, and they would sort of fit themselves into non-maternity clothing. Mm. So I had this idea about how maternity clothing should look just like non-maternity clothing, which it's hard to imagine, but it didn't back then. It just didn't. It was like very oversized, very babyish looking. Anyway, cut to, I couldn't convince the designer I worked for to change his line to maternity clothing, which I thought he should do.
Yeah.
And I just decided that I was going to try to do it on my own. And I did, you know, if it didn't work, it didn't work. I never expected what happened to happen. I started by making a few things made to order for a few friends. When I sold the business 10 years later, you are right, it was actually the largest maternity apparel brand in the United States. So it was really a crazy and wild ride and so much fun. And it kind of turned me into a serial, entrepreneur. God, I never would have even used the word entrepreneur or fashion designer or any of that. But today, you know, many years later, I'd say, you know, that I am those two things.
You are. And when I think of you, like one of the first people, and I hope you find this a compliment, I can't imagine how you wouldn't, that I would think of is like Sarah Blakely, someone who really came and changed the game for her, you know, niche. And I feel like that's what you exactly
Thank
did.
You. And yeah. Yes, I mean, she and I did do it at around the same time.
Yeah.
And she, at those days, sometimes we'd be on the same panels and the same whatever. Yeah, like kind right. of early days sort of female entrepreneurs. Although back then we didn't even classify ourselves by gender, yeah. like just entrepreneur.
Entrepreneur.
Right. Right. But yes, and that's a huge compliment and thank you.
Of course. What would you say was the moment where things really took off for Liz Lang Maternity?
Oh, gosh, it was kind of early, I'd say. And again, this I'm dating myself, but you have to understand how important these things were. It was, first of all, when the New York Times style section wrote it up, because that used to be all eyes on the New York Times style section. It was when Cindy Crawford, who was the probably the biggest model at that time, like they kind of coined the word supermodel after her, and this was like 1999, started wearing the clothing, and she was on Good Morning America every week. She had a gig, and she would open up her closet, and she'd say, there's this girl in New York City who's designing all my maternity clothing. And again, dating myself, but our phone would ring off the hook, and wow. people started flying to New York City with copies of People magazine and Cindy in it and saying, I want this dress, I want that. It was just crazy.
That
I couldn't keep
power,
up.
That was the power, right, of the supermodels back then. And she wasn't the only one who was wearing your brand, from Gwyneth Paltrow, Julia Roberts, Brooke Shields, Reese Witherspoon. I mean, the 90s and early 2000s were really the days that, you know, they were wearing.
Every celebrity.
Right?
Every single one.
I love
yes.
that. Afterwards, tell me, so you get acquired.
Yes.
Right? That was your huge big break.
Yes.
What was next?
So that was weird. I didn't expect that exit, and I didn't really know what to do with myself. I was only 40 years old, and but it felt like it had been a lifetime. So I couldn't do maternity wear anymore. That I had sold, and I had sold a lot of those rights.
To Liz Claiborne, correct?
No, to a private equity fund called Blue Star.
Okay.
And so I stayed on as the face of, I had started this secondary line for Target called Liz Lang for Target that was maternity clothing, right, that existed for 18 years. So I stayed on as the face of that because I had a separate deal with Target. But I also then created a new line of non-maternity clothing for the Home Shopping Network, for HSN. And I started doing that, and I went every single month for 3 days and sold that on air 24/7. You know, it was an intense 3 days where you would just be on air all the time,
yeah,
selling. And that was really fun. And I did that for 10 years. And that took me to about COVID time when I no longer did that. It was looking for my next move. And I just knew myself at this point. I was so used to working. I was just a working person. I couldn't imagine not. So I heard that Fig, which is the brand I currently own, was for sale. And I had always been a fan of Fig. I had no connection to the brand other than a customer and a fan. And I thought maybe instead of creating my own line, which I was used to doing, everything was always the Liz Lang line from scratch. And I knew how hard that was in a different stage of my life. I wasn't sure I was up for that. So I ended up acquiring Fig and relaunching it. And that's really what I've been busy with for the last 3 years, and that kind of brings us up to date with my career.
And that was in 2020, right before COVID, right?
It was actually the height of COVID.
The height of COVID.
It was December of 2020. So we had, you know, COVID started in March, I think, of 2020. So it's hard to remember. So this was like 7 months in, no vaccine yet, you know, lockdown. But I knew that ultimately, like, the world was going to have to come back. They weren't going to be locked down forever.
Totally.
So I kind of bought it knowing that I was going to have to sit on it for a little while, but that it would have its moment again.
It's interesting. The pandemic obviously was so awful in so many ways, but I think for some, especially like serial entrepreneurs like yourself, like, it was really a moment to sit back, to stop for a second and think about what's next. I launched Spotlight during the pandemic.
Oh, fascinating.
During the Omicron variant.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I mean. It's so interesting. Like, I know, and it feels terrible to say, because obviously it was a horrible, horrible time,
awful,
but it did spark sort of, people had time to kind of reevaluate and maybe think a little bit about what their next move is going to be, a break that we don't typically have.
Yeah, it's true. So how do you describe the Fig brand?
You know, that's a good question. Oh, gosh. It's so hard. I think that we're known for sort of, I think of us as elevated ease. What I really love about Fig is just how easy it all is. You're not like zipping yourself into corsets and tight fitting things. It definitely has a global nomadic spirit. I think we're known for our bold prints, our sort of more is more aesthetic, that, you know, we'll take a print and then we'll embroider on top of the print. Maybe we'll throw some sequins on it too. It's, you know, it's definitely for somebody, a very confident woman who's comfortable, whether she's, you know, in New York City, Paris, the Hamptons, that, you know, travels around a lot.
Yeah. And how does it operate? Do you, because it's not, obviously you don't do winter, right? It's more, or are you doing winter now? You are doing winter.
We do.
So you operate like on a traditional fashion
schedule? Absolutely. Okay. When I acquired Fig, they didn't. You're right. When I acquired Fig, Fig's kind of, I mean, they didn't say this out loud, but I felt like their motto was kind of, it's always summer somewhere.
Like Calypso.
That's like Calypso. And it was. It had a lot of connection to that. And I've kept all of that because to me, that is the DNA of the brand. But I really wanted it to be a 12-month a year brand because I'm getting dressed 12 months a year. So, and my friends are. So what are we going to do? So while keeping that resort wear element to it, we've also added, made it a bit more citified too, like with more separates, with knitwear. So we do ship, you know, 12 months a year, and we absolutely do a big fall season.
And right now, all e-commerce primarily with some physical
for
presence?
Fig itself, we don't have our own shops. I've been down that road. As a business person, with Liz Lang, we had stores.
Yeah.
And I love stores, but they're a lot of work.
Yeah.
So right now we have, and we didn't have e-commerce back then. I mean, we did, but that came later.
Yeah.
So Fig has its own .com, you know, fig.com is our store, but then we sell to so many stores, specialty stores around the country. And then of course, you know, Shopbop, Neiman's, Saks, Net-a-Porter, Bergdorf's, and again, I'm not listing specialty stores, but hundreds of them. So you can go into a physical store and buy Fig, just not, it's not a Fig store.
What retailer's doing the best for you right now? I'm curious.
Well, I don't know if I could say they're doing the best, but because I spend a lot of time in Palm Beach, you know, Hive is fantastic there, as is Marissa. Sassy, which isn't in Palm Beach, but it's also in Florida, is fabulous. But I feel like I'm not calling out all our great retail partners, and we have so many of them.
No, but you're kind of saying, like, or putting the proof in the pudding, for lack of better words, for what I love to say, is that I think these warmer climates, especially Palm Beach, the Hamptons, I mean, those are the times, I think, when people are spending the most on fashion. I feel like, you know, when it does get a little colder and darker, people aren't as excited about putting, you know, clothes on their bodies that are not sweatpants and leggings. And I think that's why the Hamptons and Palm Beach and, you know, those markets have now really become sort of the hubs for shopping, I would say.
I totally agree with you. Like, when I wanted to open my first Liz Lang store, I knew it had to be on Madison Avenue.
Yeah.
But when I think about Fig, I don't even think about it. I love Madison Avenue. I live in New York City, but I don't even think about it.
No.
I think about, you're right, Palm Beach, the Hamptons. It's funny.
Yeah.
The world has changed.
What are your tips for creating a cohesive brand?
I think the most important thing is to remember that every brand is not for everybody, and everybody isn't for every brand. Because if you try to be everything to everyone, there's no branding there. Yeah. So you have to kind of pick your lane, be comfortable with it, know that there are going to be, you know, you can't have every customer. So if there's a woman out there who would never wear a print or a bold print, she's probably not a Fig customer. I'd love her to be, but you know, so I think it's about knowing what your brand is, setting up those guardrails from the beginning, and trying really hard to stick in that, within that lane, while growing, of course, but really making sure that everything you do, whether it's fashion or something else, is through the lens of what your branding is. I think that's kind of everything.
How big is the Fig team?
Oh, that's a good question. I want to say we're about 11 employees. We're small. Yeah, it's good. It's good. Our offices are in New York City on, you know, on 7th Avenue, which has always been fashion, the center in the garment district, the fashion of the center, you know, center of the fashion world, excuse me.
Yeah. Awesome. Very cool.
Thank you.
I have to tell you, I'm like not a jealous person at all, but there is one thing that I'm very jealous by.
Okay.
That you are best friends with Simon Doonan and Jonathan Adler.
That's hilarious.
Jonathan is like, you are honestly on my bucket list as well, but Jonathan is like my dream person to have on this podcast. I'm not even kidding you.
Wow. Well,
I have
Jonathan
all his furniture. I'm not kidding you.
Oh my God. Well, I'll make the intro. I mean, Jonathan and Simon were here last night, and they'll be here again tonight.
I'm obsessed with
him. We're not friends, we're family.
I mean,
oh, okay. Well, I'll talk to them tonight about you.
Okay, that would be amazing.
Of course.
Thank you so much. But my question from that is that it's amazing to have friends who are so creative, and like, I don't know if you even feel that way, because as you're saying, they are family to you, but like, who are the key and core people who you surround yourself with?
Well, you're right. I mean, obviously, my family, first and foremost, my actual family, I'm very close to. But Jonathan and Simon, I mean, Jonathan and I met, you know, first semester of our, at Brown University, where we went to college. So we've been best friends since we were 18.
Oh.
And we only got closer, you know, life takes different paths. But when we each started our own businesses in our 20s, during the 90s, we were like the only two people we knew who were doing that. So we actually started just having lunch together every day and just talking about the challenges of, you know, what we were dealing with and how new it was for all of us, for the two of us. So that's been wonderful. And I feel like between them, a few other really close friends, my friend Arielle Levy, who I did my podcast, The Just Enough Family with.
Yes.
She's a very creative person, different, but she's a writer for The New Yorker. So she's incredibly impressive.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just in the friends I've made in Palm Beach. But small amount of friends. I'm not actually a terribly social person. I just like...
You have your core group.
My core group.
Yeah. And speaking of being social, your Instagram, I have to like just mention as we wrap up, because it's so unique and different. Like, you go on most people's Instagram, mine too, and it's all about me. You go on your Instagram and it's not about you at all. Was that a conscious decision? Like, how did this, I don't even know what you would call like your post. Would you call, they're not memes at all. They're flashback kind of.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
It evolved. When Instagram first started to take off, I liked it a lot, but I wasn't sure how to incorporate. I didn't know how to do it because I was kind of like, you're much younger than me. I wasn't of an age where I was like, I want to be doing like bikini shots of me. Like, that's just not, you know, and also my generation, we didn't grow up showing that much of ourselves.
Yeah.
Like, just generally, like, Mom, this is what I'm eating for dinner. It just didn't click for me. But I don't mind sharing. I mean, I did my podcast. I don't mind telling stories about myself and my family and my history. So what I somehow landed on, which I think is working for me, is this formula of, I'll show an image, or these days a video, typically a video of something that speaks to me, whether it's somebody gorgeous, somebody from my childhood, somebody stylish, something funny, whatever just speaks to me. And then I will, in the copy, tell a story that's more personal. I'll often use it as a jumping off point. Like, oh, I always watched Love Boat. I watched it every Saturday night when my parents went out for dinner, you know, whatever it is. And I have found that people seem to like both the video and people my age, no matter where they grew up. Like, that's actually amazed me the most. Like, someone will be like, you know, I grew up, you know, in Eastern Bloc Europe before the wall fell, but I too dreamt of being Julie on the Love Boat. And we all shared the same sort of hopes and dreams. It's very amazing. I love it. It's very touching to me. And so I find that people both like the post and they get extremely engaged with the copy. So it just started to work and I just kind of kept going with it. And I try to just use whatever's just like, I literally write it the morning of or the night before. And it's basically, it's basically whatever is on my mind.
Thank you. Like, fun to follow. You guys have to check Liz's Instagram
out. It's Liz Lang official, because I couldn't get Liz Lang. My kids make so much fun of me that it has official after it. They're like, yeah, they're like, who do you think you are?
You are Liz Lang. You should be Liz Lang official.
Oh, I'm Liz Lang official.
I love that. Liz, what is next for you? What can people expect?
You know, I'm really busy with Fig. It's really right now about growing that brand. Like, you know, we are in apparel. I'm just dipping my, like, big toe into, you know, tablescape and home. And I want to grow that apparel line more. I want to do more and more and more with Fig. So I'm still really, I'm not looking beyond that right now. There's still a lot of work to do.
I love that. I feel like you should do sandals, like sandals that match your clothing.
I like that too.
Are so into the monochromatic, you know, aesthetic.
Totally. Except I should have mentioned accessories. That is very high on my list as well.
Okay, well, we're going to cross our fingers for that to come very soon. Thanks so much for joining us, Liz. It's great to have you.
Thank you.